Thank you for tuning in to the Psychology Is podcast. My guest today is Dan Millman, who is the author of many books, perhaps best known for Way of the Peaceful Warrior, which was a book that you wrote in 1980, and it was adapted into a movie, and it's, I would describe the book as timeless. I read it years ago. I just read it again as I prepared to talk to you. I just wanted to kind of absorb it again, and it's truly timeless. It's just that wisdom will never become less valuable. So, welcome.
Thank you, Nick, and I appreciate the invitation. The book may stay timeless, but it may be, hopefully in 50 years, people will go, what's a gas station?
Right. No kidding.
Which was the site, for those who don't know the book, which a lot of the scenes took place.
Yes, the unlikely temple.
Yes, exactly.
Can you tell me what, so I'll just say this to be transparent with our listeners and watchers here. Usually my process when I host guests here on the podcast is, you know, I kind of learn everything I can about them. Usually I've already been studying their work, and typically I send them the questions I plan to ask, at least some of those questions ahead of time. And so when our team member told you that I was going to do that, your response was, don't even worry about it. Let's just go with an organic, spontaneous conversation. And I love that approach. So I didn't even really prepare any questions on my end. I thought I could go with that approach as well as the one hosting the conversation here.
And I didn't prepare any answers, so let's see how it rolls.
Yes.
Can we presume that many of your viewers, listeners, won't necessarily know about me or my work or be familiar with my work? But we could start there if you wish, or anyway.
I think that's a fair presumption, yes. So let's assume that, and I trust that this will be valuable for people who have read your books and watched that movie and know you well. So hopefully we can appeal to everyone, people who are just being introduced to you and people who have been very familiar with your work.
That sounds great.
All right.
Well, let me just say, as by way of introduction and to provide a context, I just completed and sent off to a publisher my new manuscript, the ninth draft of my newest book, which won't be out for till the end of the year or early next year, a memoir, a first memoir, which means there are no fictional elements involved. It's the story behind the story of the Peaceful Warrior's Way. And so I've had a chance to reflect a great deal on that story. And essentially, I was a young athlete. I was a gymnast, and at University of California, Berkeley, as you know, having read the book, and I was focused on how I could create more talent for sport, especially when I graduated and became a coach, the gymnastics coach at Stanford University. And I wondered, is talent for sport, is it innate, or, you know, the old question, nature and nurture? And it seemed to me, from my experience and observations, at least, that talent, if we define talent as the ability to learn faster and easier with a higher potential, it seemed to me that that was about 20% innate. Certain body types lend themselves to certain sports or other activities. But it seemed to me it could be developed. And I asked myself, well, if it can be developed, what qualities do we need to become more talented at sports? And what came up was strength. We know that the stronger you are, the better muscular control, and suppleness or flexibility, that stands to reason, stamina. But also another word that starts with S, a very important one, sensitivity, which includes qualities like coordination, rhythm, timing, balance, reflex speed. And I thought, if I could work with the gymnasts on all those qualities, rather than focusing on the movements of gymnastics, if the first year we just focused on developing that foundation of talent, that might breed good results later on. They might learn faster and easier. So anyway, my theories did work out in practice. Our team went from the bottom of our conference when I started coaching at Stanford to 3.5 years later, we were one of the top three teams in the nation and pretty much has stayed there ever since. So it began a dynasty. But at the same time, I realized that being able to do handstands and cartwheels and somersaults, those skills didn't really carry over to everyday life. You know, when I went out on a date or when I got married or had children or dealt with financial challenges or career decisions and the stuff of everyday life, those events, so to speak. And that's when I started asking bigger questions. How can we develop talent, not just for sport, but a certain talent for living? What life skills do we need? And that question led me on about a 20-year search, which became shifted, morphed from self-improvement to self-transcendence. It became a down-to-earth kind of spiritual quest, a psycho-spiritual quest, where I worked with various mentors. I traveled around the world. And it finally led to an approach to living that I'm happy to discuss how that's different from other approaches. That I call the peaceful warrior's way. And the term peaceful warrior is really about all of us, because everyone I know is striving to live with a more peaceful heart, a sense of serenity, equanimity, patience, compassion in the chaos of everyday life. But at the same time, we also need a warrior's spirit to roll up our sleeves and march into life. And what needs to be done. So that's why I use the term warrior to apply in that sense to all of us, the peaceful warrior's way.
Thank you for sharing that and providing that context. And there's a few things that you said that I just want to highlight. One is your emphasis on sensitivity. And I have certainly observed in others and in myself to some degree that mastering anything always involves gaining an awareness of increasingly subtle detail. And it seems like there's no limit to the subtlety of which you can become aware. And it's what I find is interesting too, is that as I hone any particular craft, I then become more appreciative of the masters of that craft, because so much of what they were doing was not even on my radar until I had kind of advanced that skill to some degree. So I think obviously you're very wise to emphasize that as a coach. And, the other thing, that I wanted to highlight is just turning these principles into a whole approach to life. I love that. And I'll share that one of my main takeaways from your book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, it was a line toward the end of the book, actually, something Socrates said to you, who, for people who don't know, was the teacher in the book, your mentor. And he said, I've been teaching you the way of the peaceful warrior, not the way to the peaceful warrior. And that was one of those lines that just really hit me, because it highlights what seemed to be one of the main lessons that he was teaching all along, is you don't become a peaceful warrior. As he said, you either are now or you're not now.
Everything you are now or not, whether it's happy, compassionate, there is no future happiness, because the future is always the future. And he also described happiness, or at least I've clarified it over the years, as a practice, not just a good feeling that descends upon us, because feelings change all the time, like the weather. But there is the sense of, if we ask ourselves, how do I behave? What do I bring into the world when I'm feeling very happy? We've all had that experience. We're more present, we're enthusiastic, we're engaged, we're kind when we're happy. And so the transcendental practice is to bring that happiness into life, to radiate it as a quality, as a skill. Happiness is a skill we develop, not just a feeling, which is not really in our control.
Right.
If we could control how we felt moment to moment, I would just, my seminars would be very short. I would just say, I recommend feel happy the rest of your life. Thank you for coming.
Yes.
But feelings change all the time. And still, we can bring that to life. In fact, let's start with one of the most provocative things I ever teach, which also gives a flavor for this approach to living, which is that I do not encourage people to feel kind or grateful or happy or peaceful or loving or courageous or confident. I only encourage people to behave that way. And to many, that sounds like a pretense. It sounds like pretending, the fake it till you make it idea, as if it's going to make us feel that way if we behave that way. That's not the purpose. The approach I teach is that we have more control over what we do moment to moment, our actions, how we move our arms and legs and mouth, any moving parts. We have more control over that, relatively speaking, than we do over what thoughts pop into our mind. Mm-hmm. Thoughts happen to us. They appear in our awareness. And nor can we control what we're feeling in any given moment. Oh, there are all kinds of techniques and methods to influence how we're feeling. Method actors try to use those. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. That's what influence means. But in terms of living wisely and well, the horse I'm betting on is effort over time and bringing what we can day to day, moment to moment, into life as a practice, focusing on what we do. That's the key question for me in all of life. What do I need to do now?
This was another lesson I took from the book, actually. There was another line, I think it was something along the lines of, it was when you were talking about your kind of ascetic disciplines, when you were super, I don't want to use the word extreme, but just very strict about your diet and certain restrictions and everything. And you were talking to your mentor about the urges that you were experiencing. And his response was, urges don't matter. Actions matter. Warrior, the peaceful warrior, it's all about what you actually do, which I think is a very important lesson. And like you've been saying, I think this is another kind of major finding in the field of psychology, that we typically assume that actions follow feelings. And in many cases, that is the case. But also feelings can follow action. And so if you act happy, if you act kind, despite not necessarily feeling that way, it's quite possible that that action will bring about that emotional state.
It may. That's another attempt to influence what we're feeling. Mm-hmm. There is a way to actually liberate ourselves. Now, feelings, you've read Eugene Gendler's book, Focusing.
Yeah.
It's all about the stories our emotions have to tell us. Emotions carry important information. If we're feeling very happy or depressed every time we see a particular person, maybe there's some action we need to take.
Yeah.
So emotions give us information. I never suggest we ignore or devalue our emotions. Mm-hmm. But rather than trying to fix them or fix our inside, some people obviously have psychosis and some very serious illnesses, whether it's physiological, psychological, both, and intermingling. And they do need to do some work on their internal states, their filters, their perceptual filters, as in CBT. I found it simplified my life when I just go, okay, what do I need to do now? And I feel whatever I feel. Mm. While I'm feeling shy, I can walk up and say hello to somebody. Mm. If I'm feeling underconfident, I can do whatever I need to do. And I can give examples and stories of how that happened in my own life. But anybody can relate to that. We've all taken the trash out, whether we were motivated or not, whether we felt like it or not. And in the same way we can do that, we can do anything. And for those who still say, well, wait a minute, that still sounds like pretense, I would say, what if you saw a little toddler wandering into traffic and you were afraid to run out into the street and grab the child, cars whipping by, but you found yourself doing it anyway because it had to be done. You grabbed the child feeling terrified, feeling too afraid to do it. You ran out, saved the child, pulled it back. Now, would that be pretense? Would that be denying your feelings? No. It's recognizing what you feel, and doing what you need to do.
Mm.
And you may not then feel more courageous. But, you know, Cus D'Amato, a boxing coach, once said, heroes and cowards feel exactly the same fear. They just respond differently.
Nice. Yes. I want to zoom in on this topic of happiness, because I think that many people are unhappy in the world, and we all want to feel happy. And like you said, we can't seem to simply choose to feel that way. I think there's some degree to which we can generate emotions, but for the most part, they come and they go. And I also just want to note really quick what you said about unpleasant emotions as being informative, and like the work of Eugene Gendlin, who wrote the book Focusing. And many people listening have probably seen the movie Inside Out. Have you seen that, Dan?
Yes, wonderful.
It's so good. It's so brilliant. And just not only for children, but for adults, it gives the message that every emotion has its purpose and its role in our life, even if it's unpleasant to feel. One of my favorite definitions of emotions, which was put forth by the psychologist Daniel Goleman, is that emotions are impulses to act that have been instilled by evolution. So that the idea that, number one, emotions can fuel you to do whatever is necessary for your own well-being, and that these emotions are based, they've been selected for by evolution, and therefore they all have incredible value for surviving and thriving. Yet, of course, that's not much solace to the person who's been deeply depressed and who hasn't felt happy for a very long time. So I'm curious to know, although this is probably a hard question to answer off the top, but what is, you know, if you were to say, like, what is your secret to happiness, or what is some very helpful guidance for someone who's desperate to be happy, what guidance would you offer?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the word be.
Mm.
Because many times when we say be happy, we're saying feel happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I have absolutely no advice, because again, feelings are like the weather. They change all the time. People can keep track and make a note every 10 minutes of what they're feeling, and they'd find their feelings change all the time throughout the day. And so I can't, there are many people who will tell you techniques of various kinds to help influence how you feel. But, you know, it's funny, functioning, getting things done in life, finishing what we start, having some level of accomplishment, we're more likely to feel happy, satisfied, fulfilled than if we don't do those things mm-hmm. as a default level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the old character Socrates in my book, In Way of the Peaceful Warrior, he said there are many reasons to be unhappy. Pick up a newspaper, turn on the news, check social media. There are many reasons to be unhappy in this world. Good reasons to feel sad, for sensitive souls especially. And there are not many mental reasons to feel happy. So that's why he recommended the practice of unreasonable happiness. And again, that practice is about bringing it into life, not a practice of how can I feel happy. In fact, I don't believe anymore that our goal, our human evolution, is leading, entirely leading toward walking around with a gleeful smile on our face all the time. If we were happy all the time, how would we even know it? You know, there's a saying that the measure of our sorrows is also the measure of our joys. So life is like a roller coaster. Nobody wants a flat roller coaster, really. And yes, there are some feeling emotions that feel good and pleasurable, just like physical feelings, sensations, and there are others that feel more negative or uncomfortable. Maybe you've heard that Serbian proverb, two men looked out of prison bars. One saw mud and the other saw stars. Now, both mud and stars exist in this world. If we ignore or deny the mud, we end up stepping in it. But if we obsess on it, that doesn't do the world or anyone else any good. By appreciating the stars and turning our head skyward more to the potential, to our potential, and to a vision and a goal, a purpose we have, in that absorption, the flow, the zone, whatever you want to call it, we're more likely to be fulfilled, turning our attention out of ourselves. The most unhappy people I've known are focused almost obsessively on themselves. Do people like me? Am I okay? And the more they turn their attention to others and pay attention in that sensitive way to the world around them, in a mindful way, you know, I think the more likely they are to be self-forgetful. There's a time for self-remembering in the sense, Gurdjieffian sense, of self-remembering, being aware of ourselves. And there's a time to turn our attention away from that, self-forgetting, and dissolve into the world. There was a man named Shoma Morita, a Japanese psychiatrist, who once said, when walking by a mirror, notice the frame. I love that saying.
That's beautiful.
Because, yeah, most of us don't. We're just looking at our own image. But if we notice the frame, that's the world around us, other people, their needs. I think that's a much more healthy approach. Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned the word mindful. And, you know, mindfulness has become a real thing, right? You're quite aware of that. But really, what does mindfulness mean? How can people write whole books on it? Basically, mindfulness just means paying attention. As you say, to more and more subtle things in the world, to nuances. And it means paying attention to what's going on in the present moment without judgments, just noticing as we would in meditation. And if we turn that attention inward, we call it mindfulness meditation, noticing the breathing, arising thoughts and whatnot. But if we equally important and maybe more so, is mindful of those around us and the world around us. And by the way, I was introduced when I gave a talk in Melbourne, Australia, a couple of years back. I was introduced as a mindfulness expert. They needed to have some label for me. And as soon as I started speaking, I said, my wife would beg to differ. When she sees how I wash the dishes sometimes, she always finds a spot I left on some dish. So it's always a humbling experience. So I'm still working on it. And people have asked me, you know, I've written now 18 books. People have asked me, have you mastered everything you write about? The 12 gateways to personal growth, the four purposes of life, and all the other things I've written about in my various books. No, the answer is I have not mastered them, but I am sincerely practicing each day. And if someone observed me, they'd find me a pretty good example of what I teach. Not perfect, but pretty good. Otherwise, I'd have no authority to be speaking with you now.
Right. Yeah, beautiful. And there's a couple thoughts that come to my mind. And then I actually do want to talk a little bit about purpose in life, which you've written about and contemplated deeply. One thought is on this note of mindfulness, which is, you know, essentially a synonym to the word presence. And I think this is something that people, because it's such a thing now, people hear it and they become a bit dismissive of it. They don't quite take to heart how powerfully this can transform your experience of life. And I think that when it comes to feeling happy, or at least let's say not feeling unhappy, sometimes intensifying one's presence to this moment can solve a lot of imaginary problems. And it can really just, what I feel like is that it anchors me to in a peaceful state. And this peace, as you've talked about in various books, peacefulness can be something that you are anchored in while painful emotions pass, while there's a storm of unpleasant emotions. There can be an underlying peace to that, which I access by practicing presence in this moment and just wholeheartedly, radically anchoring myself to this moment. So
I would agree. The two major premises in my work, and I mean, today it's become, you know, a thing, of course, in the present moment. Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now, but even before I was teaching, I've focused much on that. Eckhart Tolle, you know, his book Power of Now, and other people too. We hear it. It's like a bumper sticker slogan now. It's right. Oh yeah, living in the present. Well, the paradox is no one can actually grasp the present moment. How do you grasp a nanosecond? What is the present moment? When teachers like myself and others recommend focusing on the present, we're really saying, handle what's in front of you right now and now and now. Mm-hmm. Because it quiets the mind. We can't think about anything in the present moment. All we have is pure awareness. If we're thinking about anything, we are thinking about something we call the future or something in what we call the past. Mm-hmm. But in the present moment, it's like why we like to play frisbee or play sports or play a musical instrument or act in the moment or perform, because it pulls us back into that absorption in the present moment. And there's a kind of bliss, a peace there, as you just said. Mm-hmm. So, and I learned that lesson as a young athlete. In gymnastics, you really, when you're flying around the high bar, you don't think about what you did early that day or what you plan on doing later. You are absolutely, it's the present moment or die. So that's actually a beginner's practice because you're forced to do it. But when you're just sitting as in meditation or sitting quietly or waiting in line somewhere, which many of us do today, that's the advanced practice to stay present. And interested, you know, I always look at people, and sometimes it's an interesting practice, like on the subway here in New York City, looking at people and wondering what they were like as children. And it changes your whole view of them. It's not what they look like anymore. It's like they were a little child once. So it's a way of bringing attention back to the present moment.
Yes.
And, you know, there's a story I tell sometimes. I'm in the gymnasium when I was recovering from a shattered leg I write about in Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And I did shatter my leg in about 40 pieces. And as I was on the recovery stage of that serious injury, I was practicing, you know, getting back into shape and doing, I did a full twisting double somersault off the horizontal bar for a dismount. And I stuck my landing, you know, kind of went, yes. And then I ripped off my sweatshirt, threw it in my workout bag. Socrates was watching all this. We were the only ones in the gym at the time. It was the evening. And as we were walking down the hallway, he turned to me and said, you know, Dan, that last move you did was really sloppy. And I went, what are you talking about, Socrates? It was the best dismount I've done in weeks. And he said, oh, I'm not talking about the dismount from the high bar. I'm talking about the way you took off your sweatshirt and put it in your bag. And he reminded me once again that I was treating one moment as special and another moment as ordinary. And that's when he said once again that iconic phrase, there are no ordinary moments. And when we actually can live that, not every moment, that sounds like a compulsive, crazy-making thing where every moment I have to be completely aware in the present moment. No. We need to space out, take naps, you know, zone out, play a video game, whatever. But in those, you know, during our day, the more we're able to remember this moment counts for something, that the quality of our moments make the quality of our life.
Yes.
And he added one thing to that, which is another radical thing that I teach. He said, Dan, the difference between you and me, I got this line into the movie, by the way, I wasn't the screenwriter, but, he says in the movie, the difference between us, you practice gymnastics, I practice everything. And like, wait a minute, that threw me back for a moment. What do you mean practice everything? Is this some never-ending self-improvement program? No, it's when we practice something rather than just do it. Most of us do the dishes, do our homework, do our work, and so on. But when we practice, we're actually, what changes the quality of that is we're trying to refine or improve what we're doing. How many of us practice signing our name? How many of us practice walking across a room, breathing, sitting? These ordinary things of life, again, they bring us back into that moment. Beautiful. So I'm practicing speaking with you right now.
Beautiful. This reminds me of something that Coach Phil Jackson used to tell his players when he was coaching the Chicago Bulls, which was, the way you do anything is the way you do everything.
Yeah.
And that one sticks with me.
Actually, Phil gave gave Way of the Peaceful Warrior and another of my books, Body Mind Mastery. He gave both those books to Michael Jordan and any of the team who were interested back then. He actually endorsed Body Mind Mastery before he started writing his own books. So I was kind of part of his lineage. And it's really nice to have a major sports figure like that and coach who is tuned in as I became when I was a young coach, kind of Zen approach to sports and the potential.
So what I hear you saying is that you were single-handedly accountable for the Bulls' success in the 90s. That's my takeaway.
Yeah. I saw that video series, Last Dance, about Michael Jordan and the Bulls. That was a fascinating team and era. Well, maybe not quite.
That's special, though. Like, what a testament, what an honor that someone like that is honoring your work and sharing it like that. That's beautiful. The other thing I wanted to bring up here, kind of as we shift into, I want to get your perspective on purpose in life. And one of my main, perhaps the person whose work I've studied most closely is Viktor Frankl. Mm-hmm. And he would say this beautiful thing. He would say, the pursuit of happiness is self-defeating, because being in pursuit puts you in this place of not having what you want, and that happiness ensues from a meaningful life. That was his view. So it's not something that we pursue. It's something that ensues. It's a symptom, an outcome, a byproduct of a meaningful life. And then he spoke a lot about the sources of meaning in life. He always emphasized that it's very personal, that no two people will find fulfillment in exactly the same lifestyle. But he offered kind of general categories of, we definitely tend to derive meaning from relationships, mm-hmm. from our work, and as well from the way we overcome adversity, the way we handle challenges and suffering in life. So I just wanted to share that, you know, as we're talking about this, and then again, use it as a segue to get your perspective on purpose in life and how people who might feel lost can find a sense of purpose.
Absolutely. As before, and I love talking about purpose, but as we do that, if I can say something about adversity, this is something I've learned from my life experience. I often share with audiences, it's fine to disagree with something I say. If we agree on everything, only one of us is necessary. Mm-hmm. Nobody's smarter than all of us, you know? But I ask people, I hope we can agree on this. Please raise your hand, I say, if you've ever experienced physical, emotional, or mental pain in your life. Of course, all the hands go up. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, I hope we can agree that that pain, that challenge, that adversity we faced, whether it's loss, grieving, change, whatever it may be, because of that, aren't you a little bit stronger now? Maybe a little bit wiser in the sense of a broader perspective on what the big stuff is and what the little stuff is? And most people agree with that.
Yeah.
Therefore, when adversity comes, when a challenge comes, the difficulties, you see, I see daily life as a form of spiritual weight training. Mm-hmm. You don't lift any weights, you don't get any stronger. So we can keep that thread of attention when difficulty comes. Hey, I overcame it before. I was a little stronger and wiser because of it, and I can do it now. Mm-hmm. We can appreciate that gift. And we don't have to pretend to like it, but it's still there. And beyond that, we even volunteer for adversity. I sometimes ask, have you ever played at a sport or practiced a musical instrument? And many hands go up. And I can say that is a form of voluntary adversity. No one really made you do it. They didn't hold a gun on you. You chose to do that. And life is harder when you practice a musical instrument or do a sport than it might otherwise be. You could go to the park. But it's developed you. And I ask, how many have maintained an intimate relationship for more than, say, 3 weeks? And that's voluntary adversity. My wife, Joy, and I have been married 45 years now. She's my best friend, guardian angel, and editor-in-chief. It took me 25 years to realize she wasn't criticizing me. She was improving me. But still, it's not easy relationships. We all know that, even the best ones. And anybody raise children? Voluntary adversity. I love my kids and grandkids dearly, but it's not easy.
Right.
And working in the business field, doing a career, being an entrepreneur, all those things are forms of voluntary adversity. If you don't want life to be difficult, go live in a little trailer, you know, and grow your own garden maybe somewhere. But even then, problems will come up.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to say about adversity and how to appreciate that, not pretend or be in denial about it.
Right.
Now, as far as purpose goes, you know, I was watching one of my grandchildren crawling across the floor, and she wasn't crawling for exercise. There was something she wanted. She was going for a toy or something, one of her big brother or sister's toy. She was crawling toward it to try to get it. And I believe we're hardwired goal seekers. You know, in the Peaceful Warrior movie, there's a revelatory moment where Dan and the character of Socrates, played by Nick Nolte, they walk up this big hill, and then Dan has this realization. And he says, you know, Socrates, I just realize it's the journey that makes us happy, not just the destination. And there's some wisdom in that. Seems to be true, because most of our lives are spent on the journey, not just getting to the destination. And yet, without a destination in mind, there is no journey. All we do is wander around. So that's why I say we're hardwired goal seekers, like my little granddaughter. From our point A, we need a point B. Any athlete knows you can train to stay in shape, but there's a whole different energy when you're training for a performance, a competition.
Definitely.
You're going toward that point B. And when you reach it, we need another point B. That's why some of the astronauts were depressed after going to the moon. They said, what is there to do next? It was hard to find that point B. Many athletes, the intensity of training, like Michael Jordan, they need another point B. And so, yes, purpose is essential. Robert Byrne once said, the purpose of life is a life of purpose. And as you know, I've written a book called The Four Purposes of Life. I've written another one called Living on Purpose. So I am, much of my work is focused on living a purposeful life. And the most important purpose is the one that appears to us moment to moment. I may not know my cosmic purpose, ultimately my universal purpose, but I do know my purpose right now. And you know yours. So the more we focus on our purpose in the moment, I think the more clear we are. And I would even define success as making progress toward a meaningful goal.
Yeah. Making progress, not necessarily reaching that goal, but making progress toward a meaningful goal. Beautiful.
Sure. Sure.
It's very interesting as I hear you talk about this. Some kind of thoughts are coming to my mind about some of the work that I do and the people I get to work with. And so some of the work I do, as I've shared with some people who follow this podcast, is that I work in a jail, and many people who are in the jail have told me that they feel lost. They don't really know what they want in life. And what I find as I kind of just listen and ask the right questions and promote some reflection on what they value most and what their goals really are, what I find so consistently is that the very moment someone gains clarity about what their goals are and they really set a goal, they are instantly more satisfied in their life, even though they have not gotten any closer to that goal. But just having one, it does something to the present moment. It brings meaning, and it primes you to recognize opportunities that relate to that goal. And yes. I think this is incredibly valuable. So what would you say? And I'm thinking, you know, I played football, I wrestled. So I totally understand the difference between just exercising to stay in shape versus exercising because the season is starting in 1 month and I got to be ready to go. There's an intensity and there's a purposefulness to it that changes how I act. So what would you say when a person understands this, you know, but doesn't know what that goal is and they can't seem to gain clarity around that? What do you think is helpful?
I was doing a consultation once back in California when I lived up in Marin. And a man came to me and he put his cash on the table for the session, which that's what I usually did. I think people took it more serious. It's more real. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I'd met him. And he sat down and I asked, what would you like to accomplish? He said, well, I don't know. I have no purpose. I have none at all. And I said, well, surely you have some purpose. And he said, no, absolutely not. I don't. And I went, well, what if you suddenly had a 200 IQ? And what if you knew your purpose? What might it be? I tried everything, you know, but that didn't really do it for him. And so I had to use a bit of Zen trickery. And I stood up and I said, well, look, since you don't really have any particular goal, I really can't be much help, but it was very nice meeting you. I appreciate your showing up today and wish you well. And I shook his hand and kind of dismissed him. And he started to get up, but then he stopped and said, wait a minute, Dan, I just gave you a good deal of money here for this session. Now I have you for the next 90 minutes. And I said, gosh, I think you've just discovered a purpose. And I reminded him that after our session is over, you'll also have a purpose, which is to find your way back to your automobile and drive to wherever you're going without hitting any objects or people. And when you arrive at your destination, you'll notice another purpose appears. So I think he was looking for some cosmic certainty or sense of clarity that may not have been realistic. And so I think we all can focus on our purpose right now. And that's how I would respond.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And I like that because I do think it's a little almost gimmicky and almost a way of kind of trying to monetize this idea of purpose when people promise others that they can help them define this goal that they can articulate clearly when life is much more mysterious than that. And I do think that what could be helpful, you know, like I'll back up a little bit and just say, I know myself personally, I do have some pretty clear goals. Like I can articulate them clearly. I want to publish a book by this date. I want to grow this podcast. I want to secure a full-time psychology professor position. I have these really clear things. I want to, you know, raise my son into a good man. And sometimes it's not that clear. It's not something that can be put into words. And perhaps it could be helpful for people to hear that. I think clarifying what you value and then making it your goal to live out those values. Yeah. If it's your goal to live in a way that is guided by what you find to be truly important, or if you have moral principles and it is your goal to live them out and abide by them, that in itself is meaningful. That's very meaningful. And again, if Viktor Frankl was onto something, happiness will ensue by living out that meaningful purpose.
Yes. And I, you know, I also worked in the prison system before I left California. I joined and went to San Quentin prison several times with the Insight Prison Project there. These are inmates who self-select into a yoga and meditation program. Mm-hmm. Which gives a sense of purpose while they're there. And I do understand many inmates and people who are not inmates, people in everyday life, they don't know that they can, they say, well, I'd like this. They have dreams. They have wishes. But they don't really see the step-by-step how to get from here to there. It's all vague. It's like they're walking in a dark forest and there's no path. And I think it can help also to give people a sense of step by step by step, break it down. When I was a young athlete, we learned new moves on the trampoline by breaking them down to small steps. So there was, I just came across in my files a process called the value clarification process, where they had listed about 10 pages of different core elements of life, and you put what's always important, sometimes important, and never important. And that way you can help clarify your values. But that's a very left-brained approach, so to speak. Because how do you hold that all in your head to figure it out? It really comes down to, you know, what do you want? And that's such a key question in life. You know, what do you want? And how do you know you don't already have it? And what's stopping you? So one can start with dreams, with visions, with hopes. If you were magic and could have anything, what would you go for? And eventually we have to bring it out of the clouds. You know, I don't know whether it was Thoreau who said it's okay, or Emerson who said it's okay to build castles in the air, then build foundations under them.
Nice.
So I think it's also knowing the steps between how to get there.
Yes. Yes. I often, I would even, you know, propose to people listening now who are really intrigued by this topic, there's three really helpful questions that are super simple. Like you just said, the first one is, what do I want in life? And then the next one is, why do I want it? And that I find is a very important question, because typically anything we want is, if it's a worthwhile goal, it's going to be challenging to get it. There's going to be some voluntary adversity if we are going to pursue that goal. So the why behind the what is, why is this meaningful to me? And if a person is not really sure about that, they're likely to give up once adversity strikes. But if the why behind the what is very strong, if they're passionate about why it's meaningful, they will definitely strive and persevere. And then the third question, which you, what you just said reminded me, is how am I going to get it? The strategy, the action steps, the process. And when, even when the person has a good answer to the first two questions, but they don't know how they're going to get it, that can be demotivating. But if there are clear, but if there are clear answers to each of these questions, including the action steps necessary, then a person really goes for it.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. And I would add the kind of the analogy or metaphor that if we're climbing a mountain, Everest, whatever, it can be very discouraging because we're taking step by step by step, and we don't feel any closer to the goal. We know intellectually, if we keep taking those steps, we will reach the top eventually. But because, and if we define success again as reaching the mountaintop, then we fail every step of the way because we haven't yet reached the mountaintop.
Right.
But at least if we know the path, and if we begin to define every step in the right direction as that success, we can pat ourselves on the back. Hey, I just succeeded. And now I just did again because I'm making progress. And that's, I think, so important. There's a saying that I've come to live by: a little of something is better than a lot of nothing. It's something. It is something. So let's say somebody wants to become a real estate agent. And it's like, what's the first thing you need to do? Maybe it's turn on your computer and look on the web and do some research. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's make a phone call. Anybody can make a phone call, hit a number, but it's starting. It's taking some meaningful action. Yeah. Now, the why is an interesting question, because I believe in reality, meaning doesn't exist. What is meaningful to animals? Don't other animals live instinctually? They're hungry. They mate. They do a lot of things. And of course, some animals may have certain kinds of intelligence we don't have, and sensitivities. So I'm not making them lower necessarily, just different. Mm-hmm. But I think human beings want meaning. And we make up our meanings. That's the liberating part of the idea that nothing really means anything innately. We each of us as you pointed out, has a different sense of meaning, what we find meaningful. And the same thing with whys. When someone asks me why I do something, I'm going to make up the most convenient reason. But actually, why we do anything is a patchwork quilt, an amalgam of many different influences, possibly. But if we have a why, if we have something meaningful, that's obviously important. But we have to believe in some sense that we can achieve it. If we don't believe we can achieve it, it's a motivation killer.
True.
So we have to believe and see others who have done it. If we're around other people, look, kids who grow up with parents who are professionals, who've gone to law school, medical school, they know it can be done. It's right in front of them. Mm. But if they haven't had that advantage, they have to blaze their own path. Mm. And someone has to guide them and tell them how to get there. And that is so crucial, I think.
Great point. There's something else I want to ask you, and I'm mindful of the time, so I'll kind of jump to it.
Sure.
The question is, how can people integrate the lessons they learn? And I'll just say one thought about this question, and I want to hear your perspective on it. I think many people can relate to reading an incredibly powerful book, taking a seminar, going on a retreat, learning a lesson, and it really impacts them. And then time passes, and they kind of revert back to their default mode and seem to have almost forgotten the lessons. They didn't fully integrate it. And so you, especially as someone who had such a powerful mentor and who has had the opportunity to learn so many profound lessons, what would you say about this? How can people integrate the lessons they learn in life?
Thank you for that question. I believe, this is my perspective on that life, that Earth is a perfect school, a cosmic school for souls, and that daily life is our classroom. And most of us have noticed that lessons tend to repeat themselves until we learn them. And if we don't learn the easy lessons, they get more dramatic. But eventually we will learn. Now, to me, learning is, and what you call integration, is not a one-time event. We can be inspired. We can have a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. Somebody can take LSD once and have a cosmic ego death and enlightenment, but that doesn't mean when they come down and come back that it's going to be maintained. But it's a preview of coming attractions. I don't believe we learn something. I believe we learn it and then learn it deeper and then learn it deeper and then until it penetrates us. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest killers of learning is the phrase, I know that already. You know, I've heard that. I read it somewhere. I know the talk and the lingo and the jargon. I know the Sanskrit terms. But that doesn't mean much because we only know we've learned a lesson when our actions change or at least our perspectives change. And if our perspectives expand, our point of view changes and gets broader, then that's meaningful learning. If our actions change, that's also meaningful learning. I think it was, who was it? I can't think of the author, but he said, it was E.M. Forrester. He said, how do I know what I think until I see what I do? So to me, that's when learning becomes integrated, becomes part of us, when we embody it, when we become an example of it. Obviously, I love quotations. Albert Schweitzer once said, in influencing other people, example is not the main thing. It's the only thing. So in raising your son, be a good example, because that's what he's going to notice.
Mm. Yes. That's beautiful. And I love what you said, that we know we've learned something when our actions change or when our perspectives change. And perhaps if your perspective really changes, then your actions probably change too. And so I agree that that's a great barometer of whether you've truly integrated a lesson.
But it's all part of the process. We need to be gentle with ourselves and recognize just because we read a book or go to a seminar or have a breakthrough doesn't mean it's all going to be easy or we'll have a mastery after that. It's all part of the process. It's like one step, you know, two steps forward, one step back. That seems to be how it works in everyday life. I'm still integrating lessons that I supposedly learned decades ago.
And the idea that you just kind of alluded to, that these lessons can be learned on new layers, I think that's a profound point too. And, you know, I've heard myself say or think, I know that already. And there's almost this a pridefulness that gets in the way of deeper learning, you know, because you have this sense of pride, like, I've already learned that, you know, so and I need you to know that I've already learned that. And that really blocks us from understanding something on a whole new level.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a very helpful answer.
And most of us have heard the saying about, you know, you have to empty your cup before you can learn, you know, more. I don't think we have to empty our cup. We have to get a bigger cup. And then we can hold more in a sense. So that's why self-compassion is also important. And again, being gentle with ourselves and a little bit humorous too. We really know we've learned something when our humor, when we don't take ourselves quite so seriously anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, Golda Meir had a wonderful saying about humility. She said, don't be so humble. You're not that great. And so I think it's good to have humor about ourselves and our lives. And just, you know, apparently the Buddha was said to his last words, he said, do your best. Whatever that may be, day to day.
Well, the whole idea of unreasonable happiness is one of hopefully a few or even many things people take away from listening to this conversation. I just think it's profound to remember that you don't have to have a reason to be happy, and you can laugh at simple things and you can smile at everything. And I just think that perhaps by way of our conditioning, we definitely believe that we need to be happy because fill in the blank with whatever comes after because. But I think that mindset is also one of those self-defeating beliefs that ultimately undermines your potential of being happy. So unreasonable happiness.
Well, I one example of that is, let's say we're home and we're just kind of at home doing not too much, and the doorbell rings and we open the door, and it's that version of the old television show called The Millionaire, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. We open the door and someone says, I've been a billionaire who prefers to stay anonymous, here's a check, a tax-free check for $10 million. Oh my goodness, you know, we're just ecstatic. You mean this is for me? Yes, it is tax-free, no conditions, no strings. And we're ecstatic because whether we need that $10 million or we can't wait to help starving artists and donate to charities, and we can do so much with that, so much good. We are so happy. And yet we could have been that same way, that same sense of being, that joy, that celebration, just before they knocked at the door or rang the doorbell. That gave us a reason.
Yeah, right.
A change, something we liked. Mm. And Ram Dass used to remind us all that if we don't get what we want, we suffer. We're dissatisfied. If we get what we don't want, we're also dissatisfied and we suffer. And even if we get exactly what we want, we'll still suffer because we can't hold on to anything this lifetime forever. So it's a good reminder. That's letting go. And there are various teachers who teach that idea, the law of acceptance. One of my little books is called The Laws of Spirit. There's the law of presence, which you brought up before. There's the law of compassion. And there are various laws or principles, if you will, that remind us. That's all I can do. That's all any teacher can do, is offer reminders and observations of what we all know at deeper levels, but we tend to forget.
Nice. I'm trying to remember. I wonder if you remember. There was there's something in the way, A Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and you wrote it out as like an equation, and it was something Socrates was talking about regarding, I'm trying to remember. It was like, you wrote it. Do you remember what I'm talking about? Does it sound familiar yet?
Yes, I do. Part of it had to do with differing wants and needs. You know, yes, we need shelter, clothing, food. We need that to live. But right, the rest are wants. Right. And basically, it was desires over. It's like you can beg, borrow, or steal enough money to meet all your needs, or you can keep your life simple and make your needs be satisfied with less.
That's right.
Yeah, and that was one of his cosmic reminders.
Exactly. You can have a lot of desires and a lot of conditions upon which your happiness depends, and then work really hard to try to meet all those conditions and satisfy all those desires. Or you could reduce the amount of desires you have and reduce the number of conditions that your happiness depends upon, and then not as much needs to happen for you to feel that. And I just think that many people, the conditions that they think their happiness depends on are actually incredibly demanding on life. And so much has to be in place just right for them to feel happiness. And I don't mean to just say, talk about other people as if this doesn't apply to me too. I recognize this in myself, definitely. And I just think that we're all wise to examine this, the question, what does my happiness depend upon? And is there any way that I can simplify that?
Yes, exactly. You know, more recently, for one of my later books, I won't mention, but I created a meditation, a 4-minute meditation. And it is a meditation on the process of what we relinquish as we die. All the things of life. And it sounds like a morbid meditation, but it's more than just a rehearsal for dying and to decrease fear of the unknown. But it also is the best way I know of to appreciate our life and what we've been given, which we take for granted. So anyway, I thought I'd mention that. My website, maybe it's appropriate now to mention it. Yeah. It's peacefulwarrior.com. And right on the splash page, as soon as someone goes to that site, they'll see a life purpose calculator. Mm. It's free. You can just put in your date of birth. You might be surprised at what you see, a little sample of something about your life path that can help shed some light in the darkness. Mm. And also, I have several online courses, one of which is this 4-minute meditation. I do it pretty much every day. I did it every day for 1.5 years. But then on occasion, and I still do it on occasion, but it turns out almost every day, 4 minutes, you know, who doesn't have that to do a little meditation? Right. And it can increase the depth of any meditation practice we do by doing it first. Hmm. I won't go into why now because of our time is short, but I thought I'd mention that because that's how we can actually come to appreciate the simple things again.
Hmm. Well, I'll just say it again for people, peacefulwarrior.com. Full of excellent resources, and all the books you have written are on there, of course. And so, yeah, I highly recommend people go check it out if they haven't yet. And Dan, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for spending this time with me. Yeah, it's really an honor to talk to you. And so thank you.
You're most welcome. It was my pleasure. Mm-hmm. Truly.
Well, this will probably be published on our podcast in about 2, maybe 3 weeks. We have a little bit of a backlog, so I'll let you know. I'll let you know when it is published. And what a pleasure. Like, how lucky am I to get to talk to you? So
I'm lucky too. I'm just as lucky. So I appreciate your clarity and your good energy. And it really has been a pleasure.
Wow, beautiful. Well, enjoy your next thing. I'll make sure you have a little break here. So enjoy your next thing, and hopefully we can reconnect again in the future.
Love to do that.
All right, beautiful. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.